This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Another police shooting of a black man in America and renewed thinking about what white supremacy means.
When we think about white supremacy now, I think it's a great and progressive thing that we're not just thinking about the Klan, because most people are not part of the Klan.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, the Trump administration wants more sanctions on Iran. Europe says we'll hold off for now.
They're waiting to see, as so many, whether Vice President Biden is elected or President Trump is reelected.
And old traditions of Mexican cooking are alive and well.
When we survey, I like the guests to try to imagine themselves under the jungle canopy in a straw hut, cooking a mole with open fire and grinding the chiles and the spices.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. On this program, we usually take a global view of the news, but sometimes a story in our own backyard is so important, we start right at home. Today, we begin in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Sounds of protesting in Kenosha, 4 days after police officers shot Jacob Blake, an unarmed black man, at close range. Blake was shot 7 times and is now partially paralyzed. Protesters are vowing that they will not stop marching until Rustin Shesky, the officer who shot Blake, is brought to justice. Tomorrow we'll be looking at white supremacy as a national security threat. Today we tackle the history and meaning of that term.
So white supremacy goes beyond racial slavery, even though racial slavery gives birth to white supremacy.
That's history professor Peniel Joseph at the University of Texas. More from him in just a moment. The story in Kenosha took a deadly turn when a white 17-year-old walked among protesters carrying a military-style semi-automatic rifle. He now stands accused of first-degree intentional homicide for shooting 2 people. Kyle Rittenhouse was arrested yesterday. We're still learning details about the teenager. Now back to Peniel Joseph, the founder of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas. I asked him what he would say to those outside of the U.S. who may not understand the context of these events.
Well, I say we have a long history of this. In a lot of ways, this is very similar to both before the Civil War and right after the Civil War. And certainly we had no social media or coverage, but there was going to be a lot of skirmishes. There's going to be a lot of anti-Black racial violence. At times, white allies are being killed as well. And really, this was a struggle over political power and the very meaning of citizenship. So you saw a series of racial pogroms and massacres against Black citizens in the United States. And there were constant images and stories and narratives of Black people being killed who tried to vote, who tried to politically organize, who had prosperous communities or towns. And after a while, the North got sick of it. And really, with the withdrawal of federal troops in 1876, white supremacy was restored in the South. And so when we think about now, with all these national protests, really the main arm of white supremacy in the United States right now is law enforcement.
Do you see a direct and exclusive connection between police and white supremacy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think it goes beyond police. When we think about the police are part of a system that racially and economically oppresses Black and brown people in the United States. That being said, they're just part of that system. So even the move to reimagine public safety is saying you need to invest less in police as the first line of public safety and more in terms of mental health, desegregation, public schools, employment, all these different things that create safe communities and safe neighborhoods.
Now, I want to talk about the term white supremacy. We hear it a lot these days, used in all sorts of different contexts, everything from corporations that are heavily white in leadership to police shootings of Black men. But the term also has historically been used for things like the KKK and slavery. What do you think of how the term is being used today?
Well, I think it's being used expansively, and it should be. So white supremacy goes beyond racial slavery, even though racial slavery gives birth to white supremacy. So it's a political ideology that's connected to structures and institutions that designates people who are considered white as being superordinate or having certain special privileges and powers within that society, within that nation state. So even if you are poor and white in that nation state, you're going to have better life chances than somebody who's Black and at times might even be college educated. You're treated better by the criminal justice system. You're going to have better health outcomes. If you are an opioid addict, you're going to be treated by doctors as opposed to being a crack cocaine addict and be thrown in prison or killed by the police. So when we think about white supremacy now, I think it's a great and progressive thing that we're not just thinking about the Klan, because most people are not part of the Klan. And when we think about white supremacy, whether it's anti-racial integration of the 1950s, it wasn't the Klan that led that fight. It was ordinary citizens, ordinary Americans. Sometimes they were part of groups called the White Citizens Councils, which included preachers and clergy folks and business leaders, people who were on PTA and boards. And these were the white supremacists.
These days, white supremacy is being used to describe people who, in some cases or many cases, don't see themselves as being white supremacists. Do you think sort of by association that somebody is part of some larger structure that whites predominate in, that it's fair to call them white supremacists?
Well, I think there's a difference between white supremacy and white privilege and people who might be getting privilege from just their whiteness because of the racial caste system that has been set up in the United States through racial slavery, mass incarceration, and institutional and structural discrimination. Whether or not you're going to say they're active white supremacists, you can get into a discussion and a debate over that. Can you say that the United States is a white supremacist nation? Yes, it is. Are you going to say every single white American is an active white supremacist? No, they're part of a larger structure. So you can tease that out, of course.
Peniel Joseph is the founder of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas. He's been speaking to me from Austin. Thanks a lot, Peniel.
Thank you.
The shooting of Jacob Blake is reverberating around the sports world. Athletes from the NBA, WNBA, Major League Baseball, and Major League Soccer are making their voices heard. Yesterday, the Milwaukee Bucks had a big playoff game, but they refused to take the court. Bucks forward Sterling Brown read this statement.
Over the last few days in our home state of Wisconsin, we've seen the horrendous video of Jacob Blake being shot in the back 7 times by a police officer in Kenosha. Despite the overwhelming plea for change, there has been no action. So our focus today cannot be on basketball.
Wisconsin's Major League Baseball team, the Milwaukee Brewers, followed suit and refused to take the field.
The decision to boycott made its way to Miller Park. Players are currently wearing Black Lives Matter shirts like they have all season. The Brewers and Reds will not play tonight's contest.
Over in the WNBA, the women basketball players took their stand. The Washington Mystic walked on the court yesterday wearing shirts painted with 7 bullet holes, the same number of shots fired at Jacob Blake. The Mystics were playing the Atlanta Dream. Here's the Dream's Elizabeth Williams.
We stand in solidarity with our brothers in the NBA, and we'll continue this conversation with our brothers and sisters across all leagues and look to take collective action.
Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka also pulled out of her match in New York. The U.S. Tennis Association then hit pause on tournament play until Friday. Osaka wrote on Twitter, quote, "Watching the continued genocide of Black people at the hands of the police is honestly making me sick to my stomach." It wasn't just the athletes being heard. Emotions were raw during TNT's Inside the NBA TV show. Here's anchor Kenny Smith.
As a Black man, as a former player, I think it's best for me to support the players and just not be here tonight.
And with that, Smith disconnected his mic and walked off the set. 2020 has been a rough year. This week, we add into the mix fires, floods, and hurricanes. On the show today, we'll be hearing about Typhoon Bavi in North Korea.
The storm came just weeks after monsoon floods damaged infrastructure, farms, and killed at least 20 North Koreans.
And fighting wildfires in the U.S. and Australia.
dotted across the entire state. We've got some small fires. We've got some large fires.
Earlier this week, we touched on once-in-a-generation flooding in China.
The flood like a monster. It swallowed some buildings and bars and restaurants.
These separate stories all have a thread, climate change. For more on that, we've got environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler with us. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Carol.
So I feel like I should be getting ready for a locust plague. I mean, what role does climate change play in all these natural disasters we're seeing this week?
Well, Carol, scientists haven't quite gotten to the point where they can figure out exactly how much climate change is impacting a specific weather event while it's happening. They are getting better at what they call attribution after it happens. But what we know is that climate change, warmer temperatures, and changing weather patterns are kind of supercharging or fueling extreme weather events. Sean Sublett, who's a meteorologist at a nonprofit called Climate Central, put it nicely.
We've always had environmental hazards, whether they be wildfires, whether they be hurricanes. But climate change takes those environmental hazards that already put us at risk and puts us at greater risk.
What does that greater risk look like based on what we're seeing right now?
So when we talk hurricanes, scientists think that on average, hurricanes are getting more intense with higher winds and more rainfall. When we talk about fires, warmer and drier conditions are making them more likely to spread in places like California and even Siberia, which, you know, had a heat wave this summer and some really big fires. And warmer air, it can hold more water. That means more intense rainfall events. In China this summer, we saw 40 plus days of heavy rainfall in southern China. That led to flooding. And that flooding is expected to increase around the world as the climate warms.
We're going to talk about the typhoon in Korea later in the show, but let's focus on Hurricane Laura right now. It hit land as a Category 4 storm early today in Louisiana with sustained 150-mile-per-hour winds before weakening some as it headed up the coast toward Arkansas. What's the climate change link here?
There are a couple of things about this hurricane that really are kind of signs of things to come. First, rapid intensification. And second, the storm surge. So let's start with that rapid intensification. So Laura jumped from a Category 1 to a Category 4 between Tuesday and Wednesday mornings. And that kind of quick intensification is happening more frequently with Atlantic hurricanes. There's less of a body of evidence to suggest a trend with typhoons like Bavi, but that storm too did have this quick pickup in wind speeds. Now, this is concerning when it comes to safety because there is less time to evacuate and prepare, so there's more risk of damage and death if people have less of a warning.
That storm surge you mentioned is what people were really worried about yesterday, but it looks like it maybe wasn't quite as bad as expected, right?
That's right. The storm surge, this, you know, temporary raising of sea levels locally during a hurricane, was expected to push water some 40 miles inland in southern Louisiana, according to the National Hurricane Center yesterday. It didn't end up being quite that bad. But the storm surge is one of the main reasons why we care about sea level rise, which we talk a lot about on this show. Sea levels have already risen something like 8 inches globally since the beginning of the century, and they're expected to rise up to maybe 3.5 feet by the end of this century. So when we're talking about a 10-foot storm surge in Louisiana right now, add 3 more feet to it, think about how much more damage that's going to do. That's why we're concerned about melting in Antarctica and thermal expansion and things like that. So that's the climate change link there.
Can you explain the difference between intensity and frequency when it comes to hurricanes?
Yeah, that's a really important distinction. Scientists say that they are not currently predicting more hurricanes as the climate warms, simply more intense ones. So higher wind speeds and more rainfall.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carol.
Coming up, what the U.S. can learn from Australia about fighting fires. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Two of the largest fires in California's recorded history are burning right now.
Resources are being stressed to the max. Hardest hit, the North, where the state's largest fires are churning through wine country.
Yesterday, a spokesman for the state's fire agency, Daniel Berlant, said that while some of the biggest fires are slowly being contained, new ones keep forming.
In fact, just yesterday, crews responded in Cal Fire's jurisdiction to 50 new wildfires. That brings the total number of wildfires up to 700 since the start of this lightning siege.
Scientists say that climate change has made conditions for the fires spread worse. Hotter temperatures, less dependable rain, and a smaller snowpack all mean drier conditions. Today we take a look at how Australia is starting to think differently about managing its fires. That's this week's The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
This week, the government of New South Wales, Australia, put out a report with dozens of recommendations for how to better prepare for wildfires. The world's environment producer, Anna Kusmer, is here to tell us more. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Carol.
Now, this report came after one of the worst fire seasons in Australia's history last year. It feels like ages ago at this point. Can you remind us what it looked like?
New South Wales, that's the state in Australia where a third of the population lives, had its worst fire season in memory. 25 people died directly from the fires, and hundreds more died from smoke inhalations and other health complications. Here's Tony Allen. He's a counselor for a small town in New South Wales where two people died from the fires. It's from Channel 4 News in Australia.
Words can't describe the noise and the venom of it and the heat and the ferociousness. It was just awful.
So what does this new report from New South Wales say about how Australia can fight fires better in the future?
It acknowledges that the fires had a lot to do with climate change. Long periods of drought, really dry forest areas and vegetation, which created a lot of fuel for the fires. And that's notable because there's been a lot of reluctance from the federal government of Australia to acknowledge the climate connection. As for the recommendations in the report, I spoke to Rod Keenan. He's a professor at the University of Melbourne. He said the report was very comprehensive.
You know, improving technology capacity to detect and rapidly respond to fire, improving the administrative arrangements, coordination between agencies and between states.
There's also recommendations for a lot of technical improvements, like better aerial firefighting, improving alert systems and monitoring to be able to respond to fires faster. Another thing in the report is a recommendation to do a better job with something called controlled burning. And that's when you burn parts of the landscape to reduce the fuel load during the fire season. In particular, it recommends an increase in something called cultural burning, which is a technique for controlled burning that's been passed down through generations among Indigenous communities in Australia. I spoke to Oliver Costello. He's a Bundjalung man who is the head of an organization that advocates for cultural burning. And he said it's a really big deal that it was recommended in this report.
There's a recognition that cultural burning is a part of a broader Aboriginal land management practices, which is really important.
What do we know about how well cultural burning works to reduce the intensity of fires?
Well, cultural burning in Australia is a lot more common in the Northern Territories, where fewer people live. Over the past decade, fire prevention programs, mainly on Aboriginal lands in Northern Australia, have cut destructive wildfires in half. Being able to point to that success story helps people in other parts of Australia and other parts of the world who are advocating for similar things where they live.
Thanks, Anna.
Thanks so much, Carol. I appreciate it.
To continue the conversation, we're turning now to fire expert Don Hankins at Chico State University in California. Don, you've traveled to Australia many times to learn about their fire prevention techniques. What did you see there that you would like to bring back to California?
So in Northern Australia, for instance, we have Indigenous communities that are still able to use fire without having regulation to stop the use of that fire. And in the South, what I've noticed is that there's a lot more similarity to, say, like California and elsewhere within the U.S. and North America, where there's a lot of red tape around the use of these kind of fires. And so those are the big things that I really come back, you know, to the United States and North America with, is this difference that's there in terms of the way that people are able to interact with the use of fire, particularly from those Indigenous communities.
Do you think the approach by Indigenous communities in Australia the cultural burning, is it something you can apply in a place like California?
Yeah, absolutely. And California's landscape, our whole ecology is over the last, you know, say 10,000 years, we've got the continuance of use of fire by indigenous populations. And really, that was only disrupted when, you know, settlers began to move in during the gold rush and during the Spanish eras. The main driver that has helped to shape these ecosystems has been removed because of that colonial impact. The approach to indigenous burning and that connection to landscape can still be applied. It's about reading the land and knowing the landscape and knowing how and when to apply fire in a very safe manner that also creates good ecological outcomes and cultural outcomes for that landscape as well.
What do the fires look like in California at this point? And how do you think the picture might be different with different management techniques?
Currently, we have multiple fires that are burning throughout the state. They've been burning from lightning ignitions that started about a week and a half ago. If we had indigenous fire being applied in those places, we would still probably have ignitions happening, but I think we would see a lot different kind of fire, and we'd have a lot better ability to manage those fires under lightning conditions like this.
Are any states contemplating recommending indigenous fire control practices?
So we do have some shifts in state policy that are starting to take place in California. We're behind the curve in terms of where Australia is at. You know, my vision is to look to like what the Northern Territory has in terms of policies around fire. New South Wales is now, I think, ahead of California in terms of what they've come out with in this report. But the Natural Resource Agency within the state of California is looking very heavily at supporting the integration of indigenous burning. It's not a sea change in terms of policy at this point. So there's still a lot of barriers that are there.
One of the tenets of cultural burning is seeing fire as something that can be good for the landscape. People all around California right now are just seeing destruction and death from fire. What would it take to get people to see fire in a different way?
I think if we can get people to be present and experience this and know that fire can be used very surgically within the landscape if you know how to use it as a tool, that it's not as scary a thing as is often portrayed in the media, I think that by doing so, people will have a better sense of appreciation for the ecology of the landscape and also then an appreciation for the cultures which have stewarded fire within this landscape for many thousands of years.
Don Hankins is a fire expert at Chico State University and a cultural burning advocate and practitioner. He's been speaking to us from Forest Ranch, California. Thanks a lot, Don.
Thanks so much.
The Big Fix gives us a chance each week to think about how people and organizations are tackling the climate crisis, and we want to hear from you. What are your questions about climate change solutions? Email us at climate@theworld.org. And find more of our Big Fix stories at theworld.org/bigfix. You're listening to The World. Shanghai Pride has been an annual event for more than a decade, one of the very few of its kind in China. But organizers say it's never been easy.
Every year we face the same issue, and we always have to come up with a plan B, a plan C, or plan D.
Then there's this year. Pride events were entirely canceled. That story's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. A powerful storm struck the Korean Peninsula today. Typhoon Bavi caused damage, but no deaths in South Korea. Media in North Korea are showing images of broken trees and flooding. But it could be days until we learn the full extent of the impact there. Responding to natural disasters is tough enough during normal times, but the COVID-19 pandemic has made providing relief that much more difficult. Jason Struthers reports from Seoul.
There were all kinds of rumors floating around recently that Kim Jong-un was deathly ill, in a coma or something. But much of that gossip stopped when North Korean TV showed new images of the Supreme Leader this week. There he was, dressed in white, cigarette in hand, and not wearing a mask. Official reports say Kim urged authorities to take precautions ahead of Typhoon Bavi's arrival. The storm came just weeks after monsoon floods damaged infrastructure, farms, and killed at least 20 North Koreans. That's according to media reports and the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, which works with local partners on the ground there. Nazanin Zadeh Cummings lectures on humanitarian studies at Deakin University in Melbourne. She says Pyongyang usually turns to foreign aid groups for disaster relief. And to make that happen, these agencies need to build trust with North Korean officials.
The international organizations are really dependent on having relationships inside North Korea where they have access to information and access to people and access to places that are affected by disaster.
But because of the COVID-19 pandemic, many foreign aid workers are now locked out of the country. Zadeh Cummings says you can't do Zoom calls from abroad with North Korean officials to coordinate disaster relief. She says Pyongyang's containment measures, like closing down its borders and limiting domestic travel, were extreme, but perhaps necessary.
So I think the way North Korea has responded to the pandemic shows that the authorities understand and are very cognizant of how weak the health system is and how devastating COVID could be to North Korea.
Earlier this month, Kim Jong-un made a rare admission. His economic reforms have failed. He largely blamed the pandemic, international sanctions, and natural disasters. Zadeh Cummings agrees that COVID and U.S. and United Nations restrictions have impacted foreign aid, but she pushes back on the notion that disasters in the North are natural.
They don't become disasters until they interact with human decision-making. The inability to be prepared for disasters, the inability to mitigate risk for the disasters, and the inability for people to have systems that support them to be able to make it through hazards without casualty.
She adds the impact of typhoons and floods could be lower if North Korea made caring for its people a priority. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
High-speed danger on a field in northeast Syria yesterday. This video, shared on Russian social media, shows military vehicles speeding across the scrubland, and it appears to show Russian vehicles swarming a vehicle flying an American flag and then ramming it. Four U.S. troops were reported injured, and the news went straight to the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Mark Milley, who spoke to his Russian counterpart. This was not the first clash between U.S. and Russian forces in Syria. Michael O'Hanlon studies the Syrian conflict and has been following developments there for the Brookings Institution in Washington. Do we know what General Milley's message to his Russian counterpart was?
No, we don't know, because the Pentagon hasn't said, and because presumably General Milley would have said the obvious, which is don't do this. We know it's not an accident. We have a longstanding pattern here of trying to deconflict operations in Syria. We're not trying to push you out. You must not push us out.
Do we know whether this was the first time General Milley has messaged his Russian counterpart over this particular issue?
I think that my understanding is that this has happened a number of times, mostly with General Dunford, who was Milley's predecessor until almost a year ago in the chairman job with General Gerasimov. My understanding is that there were at least 10 or 12 interactions over the years as American and Russian jets were flying close to each other in Syria, as we were encountering each other in certain parts of north and northwest Syria. And now we've seen that extend to the northeast too.
Do we know what sparked this latest skirmish between Russian and American troops in Syria?
Well, there's some pretty good analysis I've seen that suggests that Russia is probing at a time when the United States is entering the final stretches of the presidential race. And perhaps there is a view that President Trump would be more prone to pull out of Syria altogether. And if they push him now at a moment when he's looking for some kind of way to reassure American voters that he's ending the forever wars or minimizing U.S. commitment in the broader Middle East, this will be an opportunity that he then takes. Having gotten his attention, they'll be able to persuade him to pull the U.S. presence all the way out before a potential Biden administration might actually do something different. So that's the best kind of analysis that one can really propose at this juncture.
Was there some kind of communications breakdown, or was this a deliberate action by Russian soldiers?
There can really be no realistic way to think that this was accidental, because the Russians knew we were only in this very limited part of a desert-like, wide-open space where there was no difficulty in avoiding us under any plausible circumstances. So if this kind of an encounter occurred, it was intentional.
Why are Russian and U.S. troops patrolling the same part of Syria?
Russian and American troops are not patrolling the same part of Syria. Russian troops are trying to encroach on a part of Syria where the United States has been central. So it's not as if the Russians are somehow innocently patrolling. They are trying to push us out, and they are trying to assert their prerogatives in a situation where they would say that the sovereign leader of this nation state invited them in, and therefore they're acting under international law, and the rest of us who have been supporting various pieces of the resistance are essentially illegal. Hmm. And recognizing, therefore, the dynamics in American politics, they're making a play here for greater influence.
At this point, what is the U.S. mission in Syria?
Yeah, that's a very hard question. The United States would like to minimize humanitarian suffering going forward, but of course it's a pretty late hour with a 500,000 already dead for that to be a meaningful goal. We would like to see Assad someday step down from power, but that's been our goal for 9 years and he hasn't left and our leverage is less than before. And we would like to make sure that at least some of our key allies in the north, the Kurds within Syria, and then the Turks across the border have their future interests protected as much as possible. So at this point, we're sort of playing for limited stakes and trying to mitigate the degree of the future tragedy in what's already been the worst civil war of the 21st century globally.
Michael O'Hanlon studies the Syrian conflict for the Brookings Institution in Washington. Thanks a lot for helping us understand this skirmish between Russian and American troops in Syria yesterday.
Thank you very much.
Earlier this week, there was a diplomatic standoff between the U.S. and its allies at the United Nations. The Trump administration wanted support to restore economic sanctions on Iran. European nations at the U.N. Security Council were having none of it. It was a humiliating defeat for Washington. Robert Malley is here to help us make sense of this rift. He's a former White House negotiator for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and the current president of the International Crisis Group in Brussels. Robert, why are European nations rejecting Washington's request for more sanctions?
Well, I think it's good to take a step back and try to look at what the Trump administration was trying to do. President Trump withdrew from this agreement some time ago and violated the agreement by reimposing unilateral U.S. sanctions, even though Iran at the time had been living up to the deal. And that is not just me saying it. The U.S. was saying it itself. The nuclear inspectors were saying it as well. So the U.S. withdraws from the deal and then comes back a year or two later and says, we now want to invoke a provision of this deal that we have withdrawn from and that we have violated in order to force other countries, the UN system as a whole, to reimpose collective sanctions on Iran. And European countries have been saying for some time, Trump administration, you do not have the ability to bring back these sanctions since you walked away from the deal under which these sanctions were going to be reimposed.
But at the same time, Iran is violating the terms of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. So why not hold them to it?
I mean, the European countries are trying have invoked a dispute resolution mechanism in the deal itself to try to work out this problem with Iranians. That's the way the deal is supposed to work. Iran and the European nations and others, Russia and China, are supposed to sit down, which they have done episodically, and COVID-19 has since gotten in the way. So they still keep they're calibrating their response. But it just doesn't compute for Europeans. And they've told the U.S. for a long time, let's try to work together to try to resolve this rather than you going your own way and violating the deal, withdrawing from the deal, and then, as I say, invoking a provision of the deal to try to reimpose sanctions.
But why can't the remaining countries who are in the deal with Iran, why can't they snap back the sanctions?
Well, they could. Of course they could snap back the sanctions. They certainly would be in their right to snap back the sanctions. They just don't see the logic to snapping back sanctions against a country that had been faithfully respecting the provisions of the deal until the U.S. withdrew from it. Their view is the best way to get back into compliance is for the U.S. to restore its sanctions relief and for Iran to come back into compliance with the deal.
But it's very hard to imagine that
happening under the Trump administration.
Well, yeah, it's not. So where does it leave the European countries who are still part of the deal? What's the strategy?
I think
it leaves them
in a waiting game. They want to see, you know, the vote that happened at the Security Council was one vote. The more important one is the one that's going to happen in the U.S. on November 3rd. And they're waiting to see, as so many, whether Vice President Biden is elected or President Trump is reelected. If Vice President Biden is elected, he is committed to returning to the JCPOA, in which case, if Iran returns into compliance, we're back to more or less where we were before. And if they don't, then the Europeans might well consider reimposing sanctions. If President Trump is elected, I think their view is the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, is buried. And at that point, let's turn the page and see where we go. What just happened at the UN was an exercise to buy time by the Europeans and others. Let's see what happens in November and see whether the nuclear deal can live to fight another day after January 20th.
Okay, let's turn to Russia and China. Since the nuclear deal was signed in 2015, Russia and China have kind of changed their behavior toward Iran, and they're reportedly now interested in resuming arms sales to Tehran. How do you see their change of heart towards Iran?
Not sure that it's really a change of heart. I think they've always wanted to maintain strong relations with Iran, although they were concerned by the prospect of Iran developing a nuclear weapon. I suspect that you might see some arms sales to Iran occurring, and the conventional weapons imbalance between Iran and its neighbors is such that Iran would have to do a lot to make up. So I think this is not necessarily going to be a game changer. I don't expect that we're going to see a major arms purchase from Iran simply because they are suffering from huge economic problems of their own.
What could this diplomatic standoff mean for the future of the Security Council?
You know, it's not good for the Security Council, clearly, because we really are in an Alice in Wonderland world where the U.S. is going to say 30 days from now, the U.S. will say sanctions are back. The rest of the council and the rest of the world will say, no, that's not the case. And so you'll live with two parallel universes. That's not good. But let's also put it in perspective. It's not the first time the Security Council has gone through a crisis. Just think back to the Iraq War. So there have been other cases where the council has gone through huge divisions. I think there's two lessons to be drawn. We're going to see those crises, and the Security Council will survive them. On the other hand, the Security Council is not that effective a body when the main powers that comprise it are not able to speak in one voice. That's reflected in the Security Council, which is simply a mirror image of the state of global politics.
Robert Malley is a former White House negotiator for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Currently, he's the president of the International Crisis Group in Brussels. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Annual Pride celebrations are not common in cities across China. Shanghai is an exception. Pride has been happening there for a dozen years. But now organizers say the festival is on hold to protect the safety of all involved. Future events are also on indefinite hiatus. The World's Rebecca Kanther has the story.
Yang Yiliang is a 29-year-old artist in Hunan province in central China. He's also gay, and he says that being part of Shanghai Pride over the years has been life-changing. It's so important to me, he says, because it's like an acknowledgement of who I am and my identity by society. Yang says it's also about connecting with a community. Back in Hunan, Yang can't get galleries to show his work because they say the themes are too, quote, sensitive. He says Shanghai Pride has offered him a platform and a greater audience. In an art gallery on a downtown Shanghai street, Yang's pieces are up on display. They mix traditional folk art paper cuts with LGBTQ themes. This is just one of the events that made up this year's Pride celebration. There was a rainbow bike ride, a Pride run, live storytelling, a job fair, and of course some great parties. Though the crowds this year were smaller than usual because of social distancing restrictions. It seemed like a real achievement that organizers were able to put on Shanghai Pride even during a pandemic. Little did participants know that this year's events could be the last. In China, homosexuality is no longer considered a crime or a mental illness. But there's no marriage equality, and LGBTQ people still face many challenges. For more than a decade, Shanghai Pride stood out as an international event that attracted sponsors like Budweiser and Nike, and with activities hosted at foreign consulates. It was organized by a team of Chinese and foreign volunteers, and the festival helped boost Shanghai's reputation as China's most international and open-minded city. So the recent announcement that organizers were suddenly calling it quits was shocking and saddening to many. Here's the artist Yang Yiliang again. Really, they're doing such positive work, he says, and they didn't break any rules. Yang says he doesn't understand why they're stopping it. Organizers have been careful and they're not giving out many details. But they say the decision to cancel is for the safety of all involved. Last month, Charlene Liu, one of the co-organizers, told me that pressure from authorities was nothing new.
Having venues close down on us is very common, right? Every year we face the same issue. And we always have to come up with a plan B, a plan C, or plan D.
The authorities have reportedly called in Pride organizers for tea. In China, that's shorthand for being questioned by police, and can mean anything from a warning to a lengthy interrogation. There's also been talk about whether growing tensions between the U.S. and China have something to do with all this. But Yang Yi, a media professional who attended Pride this year with his boyfriend, says it's about a lot more than that. In my understanding, he says, it's not just about foreign countries in China. It's more about what's happening here. Yang says it could be a signal that authorities are changing their attitude toward the LGBTQ community. He goes on to say that all the foreign involvement in Shanghai Pride might have protected the event in the past, but now that could be seen as a liability. Lin Xin, one of the volunteers from this year's Pride, says he's not surprised that restrictions on civil society are tightening. Actually, for those of us in China, he says, this kind of thing is quite common. It makes me sad, Lin says, because this is a basic individual right to hold this kind of event. Despite the cancellation of Pride, people in the LGBTQ community here are not giving up all hope. One organizer sent out a social media message that says, keep believing that love wins, keep being proud, keep supporting each other. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
Maybe somewhere in your kitchen you have a handwritten recipe passed down from your mother or grandmother, or maybe your dad. If so, you'll like this next story. One of the largest collections of historic Mexican cookbooks in the world is at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Some of these recipe books date back to the 1700s, and many are handwritten. Now the library is compiling recipes from these books and releasing them online as free ebooks so home cooks can discover them during lockdown. The first ebook is all about dessert, and it's online now. We're joined by two guests who are working to get these historic Mexican recipes into the hands of modern cooks. Amy Rushing is the Assistant Dean for Special Collections at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and Chef Rico Torres is co-owner of the acclaimed restaurant Michli in San Antonio, and he wrote the foreword for the ebook. Amy, describe what this collection looks like.
The entire collection is around 2,000 published and unpublished Mexican cookbooks in both Spanish and in English. The oldest cookbook is one of these handwritten recipe books. We call them manuscript cookbooks. It's from 1789. But we also collect all the way to the present because we really want to try to build a broad and deep collection to show the evolution and the history of Mexican food.
And visually, do you see pictures of the old pieces of paper with the handwritten recipe, or how does it look on the page?
Well, we actually have two different ways to access the collection online. So the first is that we've been digitizing these manuscript cookbooks since around 2012. And in the collection, we have around 100 of them, but 55 are currently digitized and online in their entirety. And for this recetas, we decided while a lot of us are working from home, maybe looking to expand our culinary skills or experiment, we thought it would be a really interesting idea to take selections of recipes from the collection, not just the manuscript cookbooks, but some of the published cookbooks as well, and compile them into a little mini digital cookbook that we could share online. And we started with desserts because who doesn't like desserts?
Rico, as a chef, what interested you in opening up access to this huge collection of historic recipes?
When I got invited to go visit the library a couple of years ago, when I met Amy and the rest of the team, that was a really special moment for me because I knew that what we were doing at the restaurant, which is to rescue, to preserve, to promote Mexican gastronomy, to tell the history, not only of the country itself, but the history of how Mexico as an agricultural cradle to the world has changed and really given us some of our favorite recipes all around the world, you know, from Pomodoro sauces to Spanish chorizo. when I got to actually see the collection, especially some of the earlier manuscripts, especially the handwritten ones, they were in themselves a work of art because they're so beautifully written. The language changes and the spelling sometimes changes throughout the century. But a lot of times the recipes aren't changing. And that kind of, for us, was very important to see how the foundation of the cuisine itself is still rooted in chiles and tomatoes and a lot of the ingredients that were indigenous to the area.
Amy, I want to congratulate you for starting with dessert. That's, of course, the first ebook you've published called Postres, or Desserts. What are some of the recipes people can find in there?
One really interesting one that we thought we would put in there is a quinceañera cake. It's huge. It takes 105 eggs. And it gives really detailed instructions on how to decorate it. And we just thought that would be a really interesting recipe to include.
Rico, when you look at these old recipes, what do you notice about the ingredients and the cooking techniques? I mean, are they dishes that are familiar to a modern Mexican palate?
Some of the foundations are definitely familiar. What you see in the beginning of salsas or braises or stews or caldos, the desserts, it's all there. But some of the stuff that I really love about it, because it's so rustic in itself, is like the use of the nuts and the seeds and the piñones, the use of corn in really interesting ways where you could have a dessert or a drink or a masa application to it, where the kernel itself cooked in a variety of ways and you can have pozole. That's always interesting. One of the things that I always chuckle about it is about a century back, you'll see a lot of recipes that use boiled ham and hard-boiled eggs and just about everything. And I think that just, you know, kind of tells the story of how difficult it was to source things. I mean, you can't just go to your local grocery store and get whatever you wanted like you can nowadays. Back then, you had to use what you had. And on top of that, you see immigrants that are making new lives in Mexico trying to recreate dishes that they're, you know, fond of from back home, like a paella, but restricted to the ingredients in Mexico. And I saw one where saffron was substituted for rajas of poblano, or strips of thin strips of poblano.
Rico, do you have any of the old recipes? Are any of them things that you create at Mishne?
We had a recipe for chilacuali. It's a mole from the Huasteca Veracruzana, part of the Veracruz culture. That one's on the menu right now. It's an almond-based mole with pasilla peppers. It actually has cacao in it. Not every mole does, but this one does. When we serve it underneath a dome filled with smoke. And I like the guests to try to imagine themselves, you know, under the jungle canopy in a straw hut, cooking a mole with open fire and grinding the chiles and the spices with the metate, as it's done today, even.
Amy, I imagine these manuscripts can also tell us about more than the food itself. What have you learned from these books about the lives of the people who wrote them?
Some of them have newspaper clippings where they've cut recipes out of the newspaper and pasted them into the notebook. And in some of them, you can actually see where they've reused a notebook that had a different purpose. For example, one of them has what appears to be English lessons with the newspaper clippings on top of it. You also start to see things like illustrations, even a child's scribbles or doodles. So you really start to see an interesting window into domestic life and perhaps how women were learning to cook, what their favorite recipes were. And of course, some of them have little splashes of food on them, so you know that they were well loved and used.
A true cookbook.
Amy Rushing is the Assistant Dean for Special Collections at the University of Texas at San Antonio Libraries. Rico Torres is the chef and co-owner of the acclaimed restaurant Mishli in San Antonio. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ready to try your hand at a few of these dishes? Head over to theworld.org. We've got a couple of recipes there for classic Mexican desserts from the university's inaugural e-cookbook. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. It's at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow. From PRX.